Welcome, everybody, to the 30th episode of the JewishDrinking.com podcast and video series. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan. I'm very excited for this episode because we are discussing rum for the very first time ever in this series. And to discuss this topic, we're joined by Professor Stanley Mervis, whose book drops today on 18th century Jamaican Jews.
A fellow native Columbus, Ohioan here, even though neither of us are living there anymore. And we both crossed paths studying in Israel, YU undergrad, which is where our guest, Professor Stan Mervis, got his undergrad degree. We're talking about basically rum, Jews, Caribbean, Jamaica, all that stuff, because Professor Mervis here, who is the Assistant Professor of History, the Harold and Jean Grossman Chair in Jewish Studies at the Sun Devil University, Arizona State University, and he's got a totally brand new book coming out May 18th, right? So let me just quickly plug your book for you, and then I can plug it again at the end, which is The Jews of 18th Century Jamaica, A Testamentary History of a Diaspora and Tradition, Yale University Press. So, Professor Mervis, Stan, what prompted you to study this subject broadly? And then, of course, you know, we're here really for the booze, and then we're going to go into how does this connect to that good stuff.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Drew. Columbus Clippers, you know, fellow Columbusites. It's a little bit too early in the day here in Arizona to start drinking, but I'm drinking in my, like, his spiritual sense. And I really became interested. In Arizona. Right, exactly. Drinking in the sun. Yeah. And that is also part of, relates to my research in the Caribbean, which I started to work on when I was doing my PhD at the Graduate Center of Sydney University of New York. I became interested in social history, in using notarial documents in order to construct a broader narrative of a specific community, and then see how looking at a localized community under a microscope, what that might reveal about the nature of diaspora in general. So that was my motivation in wanting to write this book, my motivation in studying Jamaica, is to appreciate the indigenization of Jews in a specific colony, but to also appreciate how they're interacting in a broader Atlantic context.
So that was your dissertation work?
Yeah, I mean, my dissertation work that carried on into this book, this first book project. The book is vastly expanded from what I did in the dissertation. So in the dissertation, I was focused more on family life because I was using these wills, and I had a much smaller source base of wills when I wrote the dissertation. And then when I finished the dissertation, I went back to the archives and I collected all of the wills. So in total, there are about 450 Jewish wills that survived from 18th century Jamaica. And I, so for the book, I looked at all of the Jewish wills, and I only used about 100 for the dissertation, and I expanded it beyond just family life, and also talking more about diaspora, talking about political lobbying, and the different challenges that Jews faced in Jamaica specifically, and how that led them on their own path towards Creolization. What makes them unique from other Western Sephardi or Portuguese Jewish communities, and what made them very much enmeshed in that world as well.
And your dissertation title is about the British West Indies. Is that mostly Jamaica, or is that more?
Yeah, that was the reason I used that is because I also had wills from Barbados, the material from Barbados, which is also included in the British West Indies.
Okay, cool.
But the book is just Jamaica. Although I do, you know, of course, relate it to other proximal colonies like Suriname and Curacao and Barbados, but also taking into account Bayonne, the city in southwestern France, and Amsterdam and London and Hamburg and Livorno, other major ports of the Portuguese diaspora.
So, you know, this topic actually first appeared on my radar before I saw your book coming out, which I'm very excited for. But I spent less than a day with my wife in the summer of 2010 in Barbados, and we had a short little layover. And where do we go? We went to the Jewish Museum, because that's, of course, where anybody would go on
right.
The Jewish Museum. One of the things that I saw was that the Jews were actually pretty heavily involved in both the sugar and rum trade in the Caribbean, which started out of Recife Recife. How do you pronounce it?
It's Recife, Chife. It's the port in Pernambuco in Brazil.
So I know you focused on basically 18th century and a little bit of adjacent, both before, you know, late 17th, early 19th century. What was the involvement of the Jews in the rum and sort of by extension sugar industries?
Yeah, you know, the Barbados actually is a great place to start that discussion because of one man in particular, Benjamin de Costa de Andrade, who was a sugar planter in Brazil. Mm-hmm. The Jews were expelled from Brazil in 1654 when the Portuguese conquered you know, that territory of Pernambuco and expelled Jews and conversos that had adopted Judaism there in Brazil. And it's that community in 1654 that begins to populate the Caribbean and North America, really the Americas. It's, I call it the seed community of the Jewish Americas. Mm-hmm. And one really important figure is Benjamin de Costa de Andrade, who was a sugar planter in Brazil, who made his way to Martinique, I think. There were similar figures that also served in Barbados, if memory serves. That's what I may have confused him with somebody else in Barbados, but Martinique, like Barbados, was having a burgeoning sugar industry at the time, and they relied on the expertise of sugar planters from Brazil to begin the process of cultivating and producing, refining sugar in that area. So Jews were a big part of that process. Now, in the early years of studying this community, people may have overemphasized how important Jews were in bringing the sugar industry from Brazil to the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Because let's say Benjamin de Costa de Andrade was supposed to have innovated these new methods of refining sugar. And there's been some research to suggest that those methods were already kind of in place in Martinique before him. So I think where we are now is sort of de-emphasizing that. But
so even if there was this overemphasis on the Jews in the 17th century sugar trade in the Caribbean, they were still involved to some degree.
Absolutely. Okay. Totally, yeah. They're absolutely involved. And also Jews are major planters. It's a very conspicuous part of how they define themselves, even if they're not seen that way. Uh-huh. And so in places like Suriname and Barbados and Jamaica, where there's these plantation economies, Jews are absolutely involved in sugar growing and in sugar producing in the process of that, which is a very brutal thing. Is what we should, something that we should consider is that producing sugar is very hard labor. Just to paint an image for you, the sugar cane can grow up to 8 feet tall. So it's very dangerous to even to cut it down. It's very laborious, takes a year to mature, and it's cut down by, of course, enslaved labor. And there's all kinds of stories from Brazil and from the Caribbean where, because it's so thick, you often can't see, you know, where the other laborers are, and you're chopping with these very sharp knives to cut down the sugar cane. So that can be very dangerous work. And then it has to be refined, you know, it has to be like juiced, and then that juice is then boiled in these massive copper kettles in order to create the refined sugar. So that's very dangerous work. If that refined sugar could, like, if it splatters on you, that can lead to amputation. And there's a lot of stories about that. It's very dangerous, very hot work. You're talking about working in some of the hottest weather in the world inside of a room where with boiling kettles of sugar all day long. It's extremely dangerous and inhumane work. Mm-hmm.
So how do they start turning sugar into rum? And I get that sugar is a fermentable, and so almost anything that people can ferment, they turn into rum. In the 17th century, right? Was rum, the rum trade created the 17th century? from the sugar. Yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, there's evidence of there being, you know, rum or at least fermented sugar drinks well before the 17th century. But yeah, the rum, let's say the rum industry, if you want to call it that, the rum trade is certainly a product of the 17th century.
Okay.
Caribbean. And
so what's, for lack of a better question, what are the economics of distillation? Was it somehow more economic? Was it easier to move the rum than necessarily the sugar?
It depends. I think I will begin with a caveat that I'm not exactly an economic historian.
Okay.
So I may, you know, I may oversimplify this, but my understanding is that in the 17th century, the methods were to export rum that was being produced in the Caribbean, like especially Barbados, the French Caribbean,
yeah,
as well Martinique. And then later on in the 18th century, it becomes cheaper to manufacture the rum from the molasses that's being exported. So molasses is another one of these byproducts of the production process of sugar. So it became, I think, more common to export molasses to North America and to the Spanish Americas, where it was distilled.
And probably towards the last quarter of the 18th and probably into the early 19th century, I imagine, rum got a huge boost from the Revolutionary War. So the America was not really interested in importing getting their stuff from the English, so they had to get their booze from the Caribbean, right?
Yeah, except those were still English colonies.
Well, Barbados was, right?
Yeah, Barbados and Jamaica were both colonies. Now, they almost had their own revolutions, too. At least Jamaica, certainly, but it was
the opposite then. So maybe the first three quarters of the 18th century, they were more importing in rum, and then once they did the Revolutionary War, then rum went down in America?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not exactly sure about how the markets fluctuate, per se, but I'll say this, in 1733, the British put protectionist laws called the Molasses Act that is meant to prevent the importation of French sugar into the British North American colonies. This is before the Revolution, and so, and after the Revolution, I would imagine it's probably more expensive to import sugar from the British Caribbean.
Or even the French. Probably even the French Caribbean. It still would have gone up, right?
Right. There may have been. Export. Yeah. I'd be interested to learn myself how exactly the Revolution affects that market. I don't exactly know the fluctuations and that, but there's various methods. I'm pretty sure that rum was being produced by large in the Caribbean until about the middle of the 18th century, when I think it becomes more common to export the molasses. And then you have the song from 1776, "Molasses to Rum to Slaves," talking about this triangular trade in the Atlantic that really connects the Caribbean with North America, with West Africa.
So that triangular trade was between, you were saying, the America, Africa, and the Caribbean.
Yeah, that's right. So let's say
and what was the other thing?
Molasses to rum to slaves. So according to this model, right, molasses is being exported from the Caribbean, being produced into rum in Massachusetts or North America, and then being used to trade for slaves.
Oh, wow.
So that is, that may be, I think that's a bit of a simplistic model, too. I'm not sure if that, again, I'm not an economic historian, and I haven't spent a lot of time looking into this particular market, but,
All right. So I've asked you enough questions outside of your expertise. So what rum coverage happens in your book that's coming out May 18th?
Thank you. Well, rum actually did factor in to some of the sources that I was looking at. So I'll say this, that you can't really write about the Caribbean without coming across rum, because there was a drinking culture in the Caribbean. There was a lot of, at least, moralizing depictions of the Caribbean from English writers, chastised the alcoholism and the excessive drinking of the Caribbean. And there probably was a lot of truth to that. I mean, even if you sort of control for the biases of English observers onto Creolized people living in the Caribbean. But that said, there was a heavy drinking culture in the Caribbean because for a couple reasons. One is that there are very few sources of potable water in the Caribbean. There's not a lot of mountain runoff, right? There aren't a lot of glacial mountains around, so there's not a lot of fresh water to be had. That's one issue. People think, well, if you know, there's also kind of a cultural aversion to drinking a lot of water. So, for good reason, because you know, water is infected with waterborne parasites, then you can get very sick. So, that leads a lot of people to drink alcohol instead. You know, erroneously thinking that might hydrate you, but it doesn't. And so. So there was a heavy drinking culture. Also, it was thought that it was used as a kind of prophylactic in a way because the climate was considered to be very unhealthy. There was a very high mortality rate in the Caribbean in the 18th century, strikingly high mortality rate. And so people thought, well, the air is somehow tainted or the various different theories about what makes be causing the high mortality. So the thought was that there were sort of medicinal qualities to imbibing in alcohol. So that was one thought. And of course, it was a huge part of the maritime culture. So rum was being produced for sailors to drink. So that was, I would say, probably the biggest market and probably the driving force behind rum production may have been because of the maritime consumption. Again, I'm going out on a limb because I haven't like looked at the economics of rum, but that seems to me like a fair assumption.
Funny.
Yeah.
When did the molasses, you mentioned it got moved up to Massachusetts and distilled there, correct?
Well, not exclusively distilled in Massachusetts, but just as a general rule, my understanding is that towards the middle of the 18th century, rum is being more produced in North America, and the raw molasses is being, or even before that, the Muscovado, like the raw sugar, is being exported.
From maybe mid-17th to the mid-18th century, it's being distilled in the Caribbean.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah, more or less.
I mean, there's still distillation in the latter half of the 18th century and on, of course. But
that's right. And it was common if you had a major sugar plantation, then you often had, you know, you had hundreds to thousands of African slaves, one thing, doing the work. Uh-huh. And then you also had, it was common for big planters to have these mills that were connected to the plantation, various different mills, one for like drying the sugar, one for crushing it so you can get the, they had these big, huge animal-powered mills that would crush it to get the juice, and then they would, and then one little house with the copper bowls to boil the and reduce the sugar into a clarified form, so you get those crystals, and then it would have to be dried in order to produce the and all kinds of features. This all required separate buildings that were usually connected to a sugar plantation.
Hey there, I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far on rum and the Jewish involvement in the 18th century Caribbean rum trade. If you're enjoying this historically oriented episode, stay tuned for later in the episode when there's a sneak peek of next week's episode.
I'm going to go back. So 1654 is when the Jews get expelled from Brazil, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's because, so it's Portuguese-owned, they're still doing the Inquisition, correct?
Yes. There is no Inquisition, I'll just say, I don't mean to stop it, but there was no Inquisition in Brazil. So okay. If you were in the Portuguese territory of Brazil or before the Dutch had come in 1630, but if you're a converso or a conversa, usually a conversa, in Bahia or in the Portuguese part of Brazil, if you were accused of Judaizing, you were sent into Lisbon to be tried. There was no active Inquisition in Brazil, unlike in the Spanish Americas, where there were three, in Lima and in Mexico and in Cartagena de Indias.
So in 1654, when the And it was Judaizers, not necessarily Jews, but those like proselytizing, basically?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I think technically speaking, at least according to Arnold Vishnitzer, who is one of the earliest writers about Jewish Brazil, technically speaking, I don't know if Jews would have been affected by the expulsion decree, and I'm not 100% sure about this myself, but the Jews did leave. And by 1654, it was kind of a mute point because most of the Jews had already left.
They scattered throughout the Caribbean. They settled in Barbados. You mentioned this guy who was instrumental, perhaps innovative, maybe with sugar processing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Benjamin da Costa de Andrade. He's a great model as that. He's held up as this model of the transition from Brazilian sugar production to Caribbean sugar production, and how Jews played a very critical role in that transition. Although it's also been argued that Jews did not actually play a big role in the sugar production of Brazil, that they invested heavily in it, but they weren't actually sugar producers by and large. Unlike the conversos of Brazil that did seem to be much more involved in sugar planting.
In both the 17th and continuing on through the 18th century?
Yes, yeah. And the Inquisition is much more active, actually, in the later on in Brazil, as in the Lisbon Inquisition.
Yeah. So going in the 18th century, beyond the mid-17th century guy you mentioned, how much were the Jews involved with the rum trade, production, any of that?
Yeah, so the trade, I'm not exactly sure. I haven't really seen a lot of sources to suggest that Jews were heavily involved in the rum trade. But where I did see sources is Jewish planters are producing rum. And I found, so in all of my wills, it wasn't very common, but I did find two cases where these major planters, one of whom was a planter in the 1770s, I've actually reproduced his will in my book, and I speak a lot about him in my book, Benjamin Pereira. I hold him up as the model of like the Jewish plantocracy. He has a very interesting clause in his will. So he is the proprietor of several different plantations, and he's a sugar producer. He's in St. Andrew Parish, which is just north of where Kingston is today. And one of the bequests that he gives to his wife is an allotment of 40 gallons of rum every year. So that's a lot. I don't think it's for personal consumption, but that would be a lot. but that's to say that it was definitely a valuable commodity that he was hoping that she would probably sell and then benefit from the. So he was clearly producing rum on his plantation. And I found a very similar clause in Jewish planter who lived in Savannah Lamar, which is in Westmoreland Parish on the west coast of the island, who likewise, among the bequests that he gives to his daughters are different quantities of rum. So it's definitely, on the Jewish radar to produce rum on their sugar estates. In addition, I would say that there's a lot of interest in Jews, like Jewish temperance or Jewish sobriety in the Caribbean. It tends to be a point of ethnographic curiosity, like how sober are Jews or how drunken are Jews when people are describing them. And in both Jewish self-descriptions, like in David Nassi's historical essay he wrote in Suriname in 1788, in that very interesting book, which is interesting for a lot of other reasons, he states that the Jews were especially sober and temperate in their drinking habits. And that's an interesting case that he's making. It's a way of saying that Jews were more productive members of society that didn't give in to the social ills that the Europeans were seeing the white creolized class doing, and also the people of color who are also accused of being drunk. And that was the case of Edward Long, who was a chronicler of Jamaica in the 1770s. He talks about white Creoles, white Christian Creoles, as being drunkards. He's very critical of white Creole culture, but he also talks about the free people of color as being drunk on rum all the time. And he uses the Jews, his ethnographic descriptions of Jews are very interesting, and he uses the Jews as this model to contrast with that. So the Jews, by comparison, are extremely sober and have very long lives that are very salubrious because they don't drink a lot of alcohol. And he credits their abstinence from alcohol with their long life. So it kind of features in interestingly into how people are describing Jews and how Jews are describing themselves. And then I would say connected with that, Edward Long tells a very interesting story about Jewish alcohol production.
Yeah.
And this is what I was most excited to share with you. So
yes.
Edward Long, so at the same time as he holds up this model of Jews being especially abstinent and temperate and all of that, they are of course greedy, and they are trying to undersell and get away from having to pay the very high tariffs on alcohol and other kind of production. So what they do, according to Edward Long, in order to skirt these different tariffs and taxes there on alcohol production, is they make this moonshine, and it's made with they call it, Edward Long says it's called new rum, maybe because it's not fermented long enough, or maybe it's, or it could be that it's from, I suspect what he means by that, and I can't be certain, but apparently when sugarcane is harvested prematurely, it's not very good. And so sometimes they use that to make the rum, as opposed to from making this sugar that they're exporting back to England. So maybe it means that it's been prematurely cut down. I'm not sure what he means by the new rum, but they make this thing called new rum, which they distill with pepper and all kinds of other things, ingredients, he says. He doesn't specify what. And they make it in their stalls at the market in Spanish Town. And they sell it for extremely low prices. And who do they sell it to? They sell it to the poorest, the soldiers. The militiamen are there consuming this very dangerous moonshine. And what Edward Long is criticizing the Jews for doing is, selling this very dangerous drink that has a very high fatality rate. Like, people were dying from consuming this very poisonous moonshine.
It's interesting. It's interesting that he doesn't describe the victims, the purchasers of that, as being the Creolized folks, right? The poor drunkards who don't contribute to society, but it's the soldiers who should be the most alert, right?
Right. But it's part of, I think, a broader tendency in Edward Long's chronicle to want to vilify the Creole culture in general, which kind of includes the militia.
Uh-huh.
That's right. The militia is a symbol in some ways of Creole Caribbean life. It's not they're not red coats who are wearing wigs and carrying muskets. They are kind of a undisciplined rabble. And that comes to fore in the various wars with the Maroons, these autonomous black communities in northern coast of Jamaica, where a lot of the British elite are accusing the Jamaican militia for not being able to effectively fight this. So it could be part of that tendency to look down on militias, which, I guess, even if those militiamen were born in England, they're sort of, it's still kind of a Creole entity. So that to me was the most interesting case of very specific to Jewish drinking culture in the Caribbean that I came across, because it also, there's this contradiction within Edward Long. On the one hand, Jews are themselves very temperate, but they are willing to profiteer off of the excesses of others. And that's a...
It's actually worse. Yeah. It's worse. It's like a predatory preying upon. Like, it has negative consequences, and there's a financial thing wrapped up in it. And yeah, it's amusing.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think that's why this question is so wrapped into what I think you're trying to do with this series of Jewish drinking, is how does Jewish drinking cultures reflect perceptions of Jews and self-perceptions. So on the one hand, David Nasi is saying, Jews don't drink, and we're very, only maybe ritually, and only wine is this kind of sacralized thing, which may lead to sort of a temperance. And at the same time, those perceptions filter through more hostile lenses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah, you can't deny Jewish temperance, I suppose, but they still profiteer off of the production of alcohol in a predatory way, as you said. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I can't help but think back to the episode we did with Glenn Dinner, who talked the same time period, 18th and also 19th century, Polish Jews, who were also recognized for their, as you put it, their temperance. Right, they were not known as drunkards, yet they were still drinking, right? They were drinking their vodka over there in Poland, but they just did it in sort of on their terms, right, in their spaces, and it was sort of done in a more like holy way, if you will, whereas here we're not really privy to how much or where or how the Jews were consuming the rum. I think it's fair to imagine that they were involved in the rum consumption just as much as they were involved in both the production and trade. Let me throw a total curveball thing that has nothing to do with rum at all. How common were rabbis around there? Were the Jews in the 18th century Caribbean, or more specifically Jamaica, did they have many rabbis? Were they just Jews and they didn't really have connection to much in the communities? What was going on for them?
I'm gonna pull Bernie Sanders on you. First, I'm going to say that I'm gonna answer a different question, then I'm gonna answer that question.
Great.
Okay, so to answer, just to kind of wrap up our discussion of rum, I will say that there was one Jew that I identified in my will record who was called by the notaries. So when you see a profession connected with somebody in a will, it's not what they called themselves, it's what the notaries called them, right? So that's an important thing to consider. So when you say merchant, that's what notaries, as a way of categorizing people. So, but there was one person who was identified as a distiller. He lived in the far east coast of the island, far away from the rabbinic in the communal authority of the place. So there was one person, his name was Avram Rodriguez, and he lived on Surge Island, like near Moram Bay, the east coast of the island. So he was an interesting And he's fascinating for he's conspicuous because having been the only individual called a distiller in my will record. Now, to answer the actual question that you asked, the rabbis were more common in the Caribbean than they were in North America. So there were no Eitz Chaim trained rabbis, that is the big academy in Amsterdam. They didn't really live in North America. The really only rabbinic authority in 18th century America comes from Shadarim, or shlichim that travel from Hebron and from Yerushalayim and from Tiberias and Tzfat. They travel the world. A lot of them end up in the New World. I've written about this a little bit. And so people like Karigal, Yitzchak Chaim Karigal, who has a famous debate or a famous interaction or collaboration with Ezra Stiles in Newport. So he was one of these guys, right? And he also ends up serving in the Caribbean. He dies in Barbados. Wow. From Hebron. So that's really the only real rabbinic authority in North America. And that's very itinerant. It's very fleeting. It's very ephemeral. Whereas in the Caribbean, you have very solid, stable rabbinic leadership that's coming from Amsterdam. So, especially Curacao, they're always fighting each other, but you have a very stable rabbinic leadership. And in Jamaica, I would say, I believe that Jamaica may have had the most stable rabbinic leadership, because you have one guy serving for over 40 years, and that is someone I've written about, Joshua Zakaria de Cordova. So he comes from an Ottoman Sephardi family, and he comes from Amsterdam, where he was trained at the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, and he also studied with Yitzhak de Pinto, the famous philosopher and economist who had a correspondence with Voltaire. And he serves in Jamaica from 1755 until his death in 1797. So a very long time, continuous service. And so they do have rabbinic leadership. And they are, and so there is plenty of there are places to go for questions of sacrality and ritual.
They weren't totally off on their own out on the western, the fringes of the earth. They had communities they can come around and rabbis they can consult.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't say the Caribbean are the fringes of the earth in the 18th century at all. They're really important economically. They represent huge colonial investments. Uh-huh. They have a relatively stable governance. And so there's, I would say that if anything is sort of the edges of the earth, it's more like New York. You know, New Amsterdam is more of a backwater than is Kingston, and so in the 18th century. Though I will say, ironically, on a different topic, meat production, the Jews in Jamaica are actually importing a lot of their meat from New York. This is something that's always kind of been a point of curiosity for me, because here's a community in Jamaica, you've got several communities. There's a community in Kingston, a community in Spanish Town, and then by the 1780s, there's Ashkenazim in both Kingston and Spanish Town. So you have multiple Jewish communities, and you have these smaller satellite communities in places like Savannah Lamar and Montego Bay. Wow. So whereas New York is kind of one small community, but they're exporting their meat, and the rabbi in New York is complaining, Joshua Hezekiah de Cordova, that they're not sealing their meat well enough. They're not identifying it as kosher. If you can really trust that this cured salted meat has been properly sealed for the voyage. I suspect maybe New York is producing a surplus of what they can consume, because there's so few Jews, and maybe it's more cattle than there are Jews to eat it. So I'm not sure, but Jamaicans they definitely have their own butchers and things like that. So it's a curiosity.
One final question, Professor Mervis. Any big surprises for you in the course of your research for this book?
Yeah, it's funny. I've been asked that question a couple times in the last few months, when people have been talking to me more and more as the book gets closer. And there are some surprises. I would say one surprise is the level of poverty. You always, and it's a product of the way that Jewish history in the colonial period has been written, as being this history of wealthy merchants. Aaron Lopez in Newport is the prince, the merchant prince. And you always kind of, right, would you agree that there's this perception that colonial Jews are these kind of wealthy traders and mercantilists? Yeah, that's like the kind of perception that you get from, let's say, like the sort of the classic studies of the publications of American Jewish History and Jacob Rader Marcus, and kind of the way it's been handed down to us. And in studying this, I realized that, despachados, those were dispatched, poor individuals, dispatched, actually made up a much more prominent part of the community than these kind of handful of wealthy merchants. Yeah, exactly. So I think that the level of poverty, that really the real motivations coming to the Caribbean wasn't like religious tolerance or anything like that, or rum, because the rum was so good, but it was really because of poverty, and it was a place that may have had greener pastures.
Right. It's a place for economic opportunity.
Exactly.
Yeah. And good weather.
Yeah. Good weather that terrified people. So people were very afraid of the healthy, of how healthy the climate was.
Hey there, thank you so much for watching this episode. It's not yet done, so stay tuned for a little bit later, but I'm going to give you a sneak peek now, like I mentioned earlier on, to next week's historically related episode. Here you go.
Basically, like if I told people, oh, I'm researching or I'm going to give a talk about Jews and alcohol, most people would say, like, what's there to talk about, you know? Right. Because there's like this assumption, we've all heard it, even though we don't necessarily say it, that Jews don't drink. Right. And, you know, I knew inherently that was wrong, not only because I enjoy drinking, but because I know so many things that I didn't know how much I was going to find.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Mervis, for joining Jewish Drinking the Show. And before we leave off, the Jews of 18th Century Jamaica, May 18th, 2020, Yale University Press. Thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.